I'm Marty Moskowain. Welcome to Radio Times. The month of July was a hot one for much of the U.S., with record-breaking temperatures in many states. August has been another matter. While the heat and drought continue to parch Texas and its neighbors, Philadelphia has had the wettest month ever recorded, and that was before Irene dumped more rain on the region last weekend. Other countries are increasingly dealing with extreme weather, including floods, droughts, heat waves, and blizzards. Is there a connection between this wild weather and climate change? Our guest Heidi Cullen says yes. She's a senior research scientist at Climate Central, a visiting lecturer at Princeton University, and her book, The Weather of the Future, Heat Waves, Extreme Storms, and Other Scenes from a Climate-Changed Planet, is now out in paperback, and she joins us from the studios of Princeton University. And Heidi Cullen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, let's begin with Irene. Anything unusual about this storm?
Well, you know, for weather nerds like myself and for folks who work at the National Weather Service at NOAA and the Weather Channel, it's one of those storms that you lay in bed at night and worry about. A storm that hugs the northeast coast. And at one point it was a Cat 3 when it was down further south. And just the thought of a major hurricane hitting a city like New York is one of our absolute worst fears, and we were all thrilled that it weakened dramatically as it moved north. But a hurricane moving up the northeast coast is not something that any of us want to see happen.
Well, in fact, I'm quoting here from the New York Times today about Vermont and upstate New York and some of these other parts of New England. Several areas saw rainfall totals that would be expected only once a century. Does that surprise you?
And we are in the era of sort of breaking these records of, you know, the 1-in-100-year event happening more frequently. And, you know, I'll say that one thing about Irene that caught folks a little bit off guard was this inland flooding. We were talking a lot about the storm surge. The storm surge wasn't as bad as we thought it might be, but the inland flooding was awful. What happened in Vermont and upstate New York, and I mean, I'm even without power here in Princeton.
Is
and
that right?
It was the inland rainfall was really, really problematic with Irene because, as you were saying before, we've had a summer of extremes, and so a lot of places, including most of New Jersey, was incredibly wet to begin with, so the water had nowhere to go.
And we are also talking during the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, of course, which devastated so much of New Orleans. And I never know from these severe storms whether the devastation is a result of the storms themselves or the world that we have created on land.
Oh, it is the intersection of Mother Nature and human nature, absolutely. And yesterday was actually the exact 6-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. So it's so interesting to be able to talk about Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Katrina in the sense that, you know, Katrina, 1,836 people died. There was $81 billion in damage. A lot of us in the forecasting business felt like we needed to do more to get people out of harm's way. And in the case of Irene, you know, we've lost 40 lives. It was absolutely tragic. Damages were about $7 billion. Those are the early estimates. So I think, you know, all of the advanced warning that we were given with this storm absolutely helped save a lot of lives.
Are we, though, seeing more storms like Katrina and like Irene, even in other parts of the world?
We're definitely seeing an increase in the number of extreme weather events. When climatologists actually look at the historical record, we can see an increase in heavy rainfall events, sort of these heavy thunderstorms that bring out a lot of water over a short period of time. We're seeing an increase in drought. And I mean, if you literally took an inventory of the United States this year, NOAA has already announced that we've set a new record for the most number of billion-dollar disasters. We're in the midst of hurricane cleanup. We've got massive flooding along the East Coast. We've got an exceptional drought plaguing the Central Plains. And, you know, all of these things, when they're happening in concert, become very tricky to manage. And that's sort of where we come back to your original question of where infrastructure meets extreme weather.
Well, if I were talking to you in July from Philadelphia, I would be talking about this hot, dry summer that we've been having. And here we are in August talking about this very wet month that we've been having. I mean, obviously, there are weather variations. But as a climatologist, what do you look for to try to understand what's going on?
Well, and I think you raise a really good point, and that is extreme weather has always happened. We not only have historical records of temperature and rainfall, we also have paleo records, proxy records from things like tree rings and coral reefs that allow us to reconstruct our climate history back through time. And so, you know, we need to remind ourselves that, yeah, extreme weather has always happened. But the thing about climate change, the thing about raising the overall temperature of the planet is that it makes the weather worse. And that means that we've got more problems that we're going to deal with, and we're going to have more problems that we're dealing with all at the same time. And that really taxes infrastructure. And what's really interesting is in a city like Philadelphia, it's a very old city, tremendous history. It's got old infrastructure, and it gets really hot in the summer. And there's actually a tremendous program run by Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia called the Greenworks Program. And it's an attempt to address the fact that infrastructure improvements need to be made and that we need to address this increase in extreme weather along with increasing population.
So is extreme weather here to stay?
Yes. I think the short answer is that, you know, with climate change comes more extreme weather. And, you know, it's one of these things where when you do the thought experiment, right? So, you know, it's one of these things where with climate change, as the weather warms up, the statistics start to shift. And that's where, you know, climate change is really, it's a statistical issue where it's pushing us towards more extremes. So, for example, in a city like New York today, the 1-in-100-year flood right now, it's actually happening every 80 years. And within the next 10 years, it's going to be happening every 40 years. So think about these massive flooding events happening more and more frequently. If we don't address our infrastructure needs, we're going to be in big trouble.
So here's some really basic questions then about climate change. How can global warming, as it used to be called, how can that cause both or droughts, blizzards, flooding, the kind of extremes that we've been talking about?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think, you know, that's the thing about climate change is that sometimes it can be just a little bit tough to wrap your head around because it infiltrates our weather, so to speak, in a number of different ways. And so as you warm up the planet, and if you think of global warming as literally just this global increase in the average temperature over the past century, it's warmed about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. What that warming does is it evaporates more water. Our oceans have warmed up just like our land surfaces, and more moisture is in the air. Over the past 30 years, we've seen about a 4% increase in water vapor. With that additional water vapor, that additional moisture in the atmosphere fuels storms. So these heavy downpours, hurricanes, events like that have more fuel, more ability to rain out. But what we say about climate change and the way the warming works itself into these large-scale climate patterns is that ultimately the rich get richer and the poor get poorer from a weather standpoint, in the sense that those places that are already dry tend to get drier. Think about the U.S. Southwest. Those places that are wet will tend to get wetter. Think about Northeast and floods.
Talk to us about the human-made impact. And this, of course, is where things can get controversial. I realize most scientists have a consensus about this, but nonetheless, there are those who question climate change or global warming and whether it's human-made or not. How do you see the role of humans?
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a really important point that we need to just help folks work through, in the sense that I think as scientists, we need to help walk people through four basic points of science. One is that global warming is real. We can measure it. We have measured it. Second is that actually it is our fault, that we can measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that traps heat and is the primary cause of this warming. We know that roughly one out of every four carbon dioxide molecules in our atmosphere today were put there by us by burning things like coal and oil and natural gas. We then have to help people understand how that warming makes its way into our weather and that it's a threat to us as a society. But then we've got to help folks understand that we can actually fix this, because if we leave people feeling like there are no solutions, then it's really tough. And so, you know, I think it's understandable that there's a lot of questions about the issue because it has tremendous political implications. I mean, we've been working on the science of climate change and global warming for over 150 years. It's actually not that complicated. But when scientists basically make the point that burning fossil fuels is problematic, that's a huge finding, and it has tremendous political implications. So the way climate connects to energy becomes, you know, a really hot button issue.
Well, and I want to get to all of those points, but one that I scribbled down here, then, help us understand the kind of human fingerprints that you see on carbon, on CO2.
Yes, that is such a great question. And in science, we call this attribution science. So it's kind of like the way epidemiologists would try to understand how cigarette smoking increased the risk of lung cancer. Very similar kinds of statistical techniques are used to figure out to what extent our human fingerprint is part of this long-term warming trend. And attribution science has allowed us to very clearly understand that the Earth would not have warmed nearly as much over the past century if it wasn't for us burning fossil fuels. And we do that through chemical fingerprinting, so using instruments like a mass spectrometer to measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And what's really kind of cool is that CO2 molecules actually have different chemical signatures. There's different isotopes of carbon, and we know that carbon isotopes that are depleted in certain numbers, in C13 and C14, those come from burning fossil fuel. So we can chemically fingerprint the carbon dioxide and attribute it to human actions. And we can use climate models to attempt to recreate the trend. And when we run climate models, we can see that Mother Nature on her own can't make it warm to the extent that it has warmed. So things like internal variability of the oceans, volcanic activity, all of these things that Mother Nature has in her bag of tricks can't reproduce the warming. The only thing that makes it warm up in the end is human actions and burning fossil fuels. So there's a really nice body of science to support that. And that's, I think, one of the challenges for scientists, is just to help people understand that we've been working on this problem for a really long time and we understand it pretty well.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open up the phone lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we've invited Heidi Cullen to be our guest in this hour of Radio Time, Senior Research Scientist with Climate Central. She's currently a visiting lecturer at Princeton University. She wrote a book last year, now out in paperback, called The Weather of the Future, Heat Waves, Extreme Storms, and Other Scenes from a Climate Changed Planet. And she joins us from the Broadcast Center at Princeton University. We're going to be talking much more after this very short break. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA has art classes and workshops this fall in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Featuring Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and master classes with classical realist artist and author Juliet Aristides and noted painters Bill Scott and Stuart Shills. PAFA CE, a community of artists of all ages and levels. Classes begin September 8th. For details, pafa.edu/CE.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM. Or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast. And you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Next time in Studio 360.
This should be a book that's read every 5 years, because it's like food, man. It ain't McDonald's, man. autobiography of Malcolm X is sit down, say grace, and eat your food very slowly as we sit around this table and do it.
Public Enemy's Chuck D on the autobiography of Malcolm X. That's next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with climatologist Heidi Cullen about some of the wild weather we've been having, weather extremes and climate change. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You write in your book, and I circled it here, here's something that most climate scientists won't tell you about climate change. The Earth is going to be fine. Why is that important to know?
Because I think there's a certain tendency to think of climate change as strictly this, you know, kind of environmental issue, when climate change is all about us, you know. And I've spent a lot of time looking at sort of the archaeological record. And if you read books like Jared Diamond's Collapse, you look at how human societies have interacted with our climate system. I mean, modern agriculture is based on the fact that we've got a good, robust climate system to allow us to plant crops. But there's plenty of instances in history where sophisticated societies have collapsed as a result of an inability to adapt to a change in climate, a drought, for example. And so I think, you know, it's important for us to just remember that, look, we're not that special. We are vulnerable to weather and climate, and we need to start factoring it in to the way we plan our cities and the way we build our infrastructure.
In fact, you say, and this is about human beings, that as human beings, we're better at solving problems that feel imminent than abstract dangers.
Oh, and that, I think that's just getting worse as we become more technologically proficient. Yeah, taking the long view is hard, and I think that it's so critical with issues like this, right?
Well, and also I do think, as someone who basically lives in the world of news, there's so much bad news in the last year or so, it's almost hard to know how to prioritize. What should I worry about today? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I think with something like climate change and the intersection of extreme weather and climate, I think, is this tremendous opportunity to, you know, we have just been in, you know, massive coverage of Irene. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was excellent coverage. I think it got a lot of people out of harm's way. I think it gave our leaders an opportunity to really step up and say, this is what you guys need to do. I think overall it was a successful effort to keep people out of harm's way. But now the opportunity is to continue the dialogue and say, what can we learn from this event? Where are our biggest Achilles heels? And start asking the hard, long-term questions. And that's, you know, we have a tendency to move from one crisis to the next and not stop and say, okay, let's fix this now.
So as a climatologist, what then should we be focusing on? What do you think? And we meaning, I guess, the worldwide population, but what should be our top priority?
Well, yeah, as a climatologist, I'll say that I think in general, our group of scientists, we tend to look at the long picture, the big picture, I should say. And, you know, by definition, right, climate is the average of weather over long periods of time. So we are, by definition, the kind of people who sit down and try to get a big picture overview of the issues. And so, you know, what I'd say I really would love to see us as a society do is not strictly focus on the short term. And forecasting is a big aspect of this, right? I mean, Irene was an excellent example of how science has allowed us to open a window into the future and track an event. I mean, last week on Tuesday, we already knew that Irene was coming. And with climate change, the question is, okay, we have a pretty decent sense of what's coming 25, 30 years down the road. How do we as a society take that information in and plan around it? That's sort of the big challenge for us.
Well, one of the cities that you focus on is Manhattan, but I think that could be a stand-in for a lot of other cities. And you look into the future, seeing Manhattan in a couple of decades. Hence, what do you see?
Well, and I'll say that the focus on these different places around the United States was kind of a direct byproduct of my experience at the Weather Channel during Hurricane Katrina, because again, it was sort of this confluence of the right now, the imminent disaster that was unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico as Katrina strengthened, and the big long-term picture where scientists, you know, 25 years before Katrina hit New Orleans were saying, look, we've got tremendous vulnerability. We can't tell you exactly when a Cat 3 hurricane is going to hit, but it's going to hit eventually. And I think that's sort of that's the issue that we're dealing with is there's a certain amount of things that we will never be able to predict, but that we know are inevitable. And how do we plan for those things? And so the book was an attempt to say, okay, if we step back and looked at all of the other places in the U.S. and around the world that have vulnerabilities just like New Orleans did, what would we need to be doing right now? And New York is definitely a stand-in for just about any major city in the Northeast, in the sense that it's got history, it's got old infrastructure, it's got a growing population, increasing energy demand, and then increasing extreme events. And so how do we manage all of these coming together at one period of time?
Well, you describe a city with seawalls, rebuilt infrastructure, I guess, to keep what, rising oceans at bay?
Yep. And I mean, look, I'm kind of an infrastructure junkie. I'm a weather nerd and an infrastructure junkie. And you look at a city like New York with just, I mean, it's an amazing city. And you look at the vulnerabilities that this island essentially has. And, you know, we know that extreme weather happens all the time. We know that, for example, the return period for a Category 3 hurricane for Manhattan is about once every 70 years. So, you know, Irene made landfall as a tropical storm, essentially, but we know that at some point in the future, Manhattan will see a Category 3 storm. It's sort of inevitable. I can't tell you when, but what can we do now in advance? Because we know, and we learned this from New Orleans, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to do this stuff up front before the disaster than to do it afterwards. So, you know, and these are not sexy things. Don't get
no,
me wrong.
Not.
This is where people's eyes start to glaze over and they're like, okay, we've got to fix storm drains. We've got to improve our capacity to pump water out. We've got to think about seawalls. But interestingly enough, you know, within Manhattan, Mayor Bloomberg has formed a climate change task force. They've brought the Dutch in because the Dutch are sort of the masters of flood control. And New York has begun to ask these hard questions of how do we protect this incredible city from Mother Nature?
Well, let me ask a question then in another way. And I do want to get to our callers. But if fossil fuels in many way are driving climate change, if we were to get off of fossil fuels, and of course that would take some time, what would be the impact looking ahead on climate change?
Well, anything that we do to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels will reduce the overall forecast, right? The overall forecast for warming. And this is sort of where these long-range projections come in, where by the middle of the century, we're talking, you know, about 4 or 5 degrees average warming. And anything we do to mitigate, reduce our CO2 emissions will reduce the overall warming. And that's why a lot of scientists will say that climate change is sort of this management problem that's part mitigation or reducing emissions, and it's also part adaptation or improving our infrastructure and protecting ourselves from what's in the pipeline already.
Well, and not to focus too much on gloom and doom, you actually have a very interesting perspective on Africa in the year 2050, that Africa, which has lots of sunshine, would be selling solar energy to Europe.
And you know what? I think that the U.S. could do the exact same thing. And this was one of the lessons that I really took to heart when I was at the Weather Channel, which was we had a tendency, for all of the obvious reasons, to focus on the impending disaster to help keep people out of harm's way. And it was like, okay, the U.S., we know where Tornado Alley is. We know where Hurricane Alley is. But do we know where the wind belt is? Do we know that the U.S. Southwest has tremendous solar resources? And it's sort of this opportunity to say, you know what? Weather comes with its set of problems, but weather is also energy. Mm-hmm. It's wind and solar power. And if we can capitalize on that, you know, we're halfway there.
Well, and that and the Africa part speaks to that belt in the middle of Africa where there's been a serious drought, and we know, of course, about the crisis in Somalia. But it's interesting to think of them as providing energy to a lot of the rest of the world.
And that's where we really need to take into account everyone's sort of natural strengths when it comes to climate and sort of help. I mean, the thing about the larger issue of how do we solve this problem globally and why something, for example, like the Kyoto Protocol has been somewhat of a failure is that we cannot separate the environmental aspect of climate change from the economic and development issues. That, you know, climate change is bigger than any problem we've had to deal with. It's not like acid rain. It's not a pollution problem because it's jointly a development problem and an environmental problem. And until we can solve both of those problems together and help countries like Africa leapfrog over fossil fuels that we used to grow our economies, we've got to figure out how to do that. And I think that's what makes the problem, you know, probably the biggest problem of our lifetime.
And that's Heidi Collin, senior research scientist with Climate Central. She's a visiting lecturer at Princeton University, and her book, The Weather of the Future, is now out in paperback. And she joins us from the Broadcast Center at Princeton University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get some callers into the conversation. We'll start with Sean from Bucks County. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I guess my concern is that it seems a little disingenuous to claim that humans are the cause of climate change or global warming. I mean, we've known that since the end of the last ice age, some 30 to 50,000 years ago, that the planet is warming. So it's really the rate of change that we have caused, and that's what's hard on ecosystems. They can't keep up.
Well, Sean, let me give Heidi Cullen a chance to respond to your call, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Heidi, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, Sean, I think that's a really important point to make, is that one of the aspects of climate change that's really tough is that we're adding this CO2 to the atmosphere at such a rate that our climate is changing very rapidly, and that's the part that makes it tough to adapt to, because we've got to adapt on timescales that we're not used to adapting on, especially for ecosystems and wildlife.
Well, and I've heard it described as trying to move an ocean liner, which is that it just takes a long time for an ocean liner to make a turn. Is that helpful to understand how whatever we do to try to reduce global warming or climate change, that's the kind of timetable?
I think that's a really good analogy, and that's sort of where, when we come back to how the media tends to cover topics and how we tell stories that are very immediate and we jump from one crisis to the next. This is really a long-term sustained effort that's going to just take a lot of people working together ultimately the real question that we're answering here is how do we all fit on this small planet and supply the energy that we need to survive and manage our resources in such a way that they're sustainable. That's sort of the bigger question that we're talking about here, because by the middle of the century, we're going to have upwards of 9 or 10 billion people, and we're going to have a doubling of our energy needs. So it really transfers into this management problem.
Well, you're a climatologist, but that raises the issue of population control. Do you think that's...
I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we can't separate out any one aspect of this. I was just in a conversation about water resource management in the U.S. Southwest. So, you know, we have an ecosystem that's very arid, and it is literally the fastest growing population center in the United States. So you've got population growth along with water resource limitations, and then a long-range climate forecast where it's going to get drier and drier as we move out in time. And so the way those three problems come together, it really becomes a difficult question. And, you know, it's a hard question.
Sure.
to grapple with, essentially.
Let me see what Carl from Hampton, New Jersey has to say. And Carl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
This is Carl from New Jersey.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if your guest could comment on the role of sunspots in global warming. For example, a negative example, between 1645 and 1715, there were few sunspots, and we were in a mini ice age in Europe. And I'll take my answer over the radio.
Okay, fair enough. Heidi Cullen, go ahead. Sunspots.
Yeah, I mean, sunspots play a role in climate, but when it comes to the long-term recent trend in warming, sunspots basically can't rise above the noise. And we know that sunspots cannot explain the long-term warming trend. So, yeah, have they played a role in past climate cycles? Absolutely. But are they the driving cause of this long-term warming trend? Absolutely not.
Carl, thanks for calling into Radio Time. Just looks like we have almost a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Heidi, you describe the impact of climate change on northern parts of the world and then on southern parts of the world. What do you see as the most, I guess, dramatic difference?
The way climate change works is that, you know, again, it's kind of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So, you know, the Middle East, the Mediterranean, Africa, Mexico, these are parts of the world that are going to get hit the hardest. And, you know, we're going to see the most rapid change at the higher latitudes. But in terms of things like agricultural yield, we could actually see short-term increases higher up in places like Canada. Mm. And, you know, globally, one of the estimates that that agronomists tend to use is that for every 1.8 degrees of warming that we see, we'll likely see a global reduction in crop yields by about 10%. So, you know, overall, it's a decline, but we're going to see some regional growth in some areas, and then other folks are just going to get hit a lot harder.
So you're talking about countries like, as you said, Canada, Greenland, Russia, having more, what, usable arable land?
Yeah, we're going to see them warm up more, and so the kind of soils that can grow crops will probably increase, whereas places like Mexico, the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, both from the water resources standpoint and the agricultural standpoint, they're going to see some trouble.
Do you see then a change in the worldwide diet if things are grown more in northern climates?
I think that we're going to have to, again, adapt, right? And one of the things about climate change is that it's coping versus adapting. Coping is, you know, shutting down the subway system in New York in advance of Irene. Adapting is taking this long-term forecast and just figuring out how best to move forward. And it's interesting. The U.S. National Science Foundation just published a report called America's Climate Choices. And in it, it basically said, we know that climate change is real. Mm. We know that we have to do something about it. The sooner we start, the better off we are. But we don't know everything. And so therefore, we have to, the words that they use are iterative risk management. It's just move forward, make some changes, and then assess the situation and make changes that are working, stop doing the things that aren't working, and then continue to move ahead. And I think that's kind of how we have to look at this situation, where it's going to just take baby steps moving forward, but the sooner we get started, the better off we are.
We're almost up on a break here, but that seems so rational.
Yes, that is pretty rational.
take baby steps to try to address a problem. Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with climatologist Heidi Cullen. Again, she's senior research scientist with Climate Central, and she's a visiting lecturer at Princeton University. And her book written last year, The Weather of the Future, Heat Waves, Extreme Storms, and Other Scenes from a Climate Change Planet, now out in paperback. And we'll get back to our callers after this very short break, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111, 215-762-1111.
On the next Fresh Air, our food week continues with the story of bananas, why they often don't taste like they used to, and why their future is endangered. We'll hear from Dan Capel, author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Also, New Yorker science writer Michael Spector on the possibility of creating hamburgers in test tubes. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll get an update on the tense situation in Syria. Also, how are students at public colleges faring? Well, they're working two or more jobs to make it and struggling to find room in required courses. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Our guest climatologist Heidi Collins says there's a connection between extreme weather and climate change, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Let me get to, looks like Larry from Warminster to join our conversation. And Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for this excellent show, Marty.
Thanks.
And I'm a great fan of Dr. Cullen, and I miss her on the Weather Channel probably more than she misses being there. But Dr. Cullen, you've fingered human-induced carbon dioxide emissions as part of the problem. And there's been reports from Rocky Mountain Institute and others that say that we're wasting more than half the carbon that we burn. So how do you think that figures in a plan to begin to take larger steps to reduce our emissions, to eliminate that waste?
Well, Larry, let me toss it to Heidi Cullen, and go ahead, Heidi.
Well, first of all, Larry, thank you so much. I really appreciate the kind words. And, you know, you've hit the nail on the head, essentially. When it comes to climate change, you know, adaptation is important. Reducing emissions is important. But efficiency is sort of the single lowest hanging fruit that we can deal with. And actually, folks here at Princeton, Rob Sokolow and Steve Pakala, you know, attempted to look at climate change as a solvable problem and just sort of cut slices of a pie and said, if we reduce our overall demand for energy, that is one of the simplest, most easy things to do that saves us money. And, you know, I think that really is I think the easiest place to begin, especially now that we're in a recession where, you know, budgets are tight. And, you know, the McKinsey report that came out with this, I think, showed really clearly that there's plenty of places where we can just increase our overall efficiency of energy use and you know, tune up leaky pipes. I mean, it's just kind of this infrastructure issue that we've come back to. But I couldn't agree more. If we don't tackle the efficiency aspect of this, we're just missing a huge opportunity.
Larry, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Heidi Cullen, do you miss the Weather Channel or no?
Oh, my goodness. I'm a total weather nerd. So I, you know, I was like tuned into the Weather Channel all weekend long watching. And, you know, I do miss it. And, you know, one of the things about Climate Central, where I work now, is that we're collaborating with several different organizations, including the Weather Channel. And we're really serving as a nonprofit science journalism organization. And so, you know, in this, you know, wave of cuts that we've seen throughout science journalism, our organization is really hoping to serve as, you know, as a resource for folks who want to report on the issue but can't necessarily afford to do it.
Well, weather journalists and frankly other journalists have been criticized over the last couple of weeks for not just hyping the storm but the kind of breathless coverage of Irene. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
You know, I really believe that storms are tough, you know, and hurricanes, the track forecasts have improved dramatically. The intensity forecasts are really hard to get right. But overall, I think that you know, the thousands of people that were involved in this coverage did a really solid job. You know, again, was there hype in some respects? You know, probably. But I think overall we really help to keep people out of harm's way, and I'm a big defender of you know, hope for the best but prepare for the worst. And I thought it was a really nice moment to see people, you know, taking this storm really seriously. And, you know, after a winter where we could argue that certain storms were not necessarily well managed, I saw a lot of good things happening here.
Let me get Paul from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
When you look at public concern, like polls of public concern, I think climate change or what used to be global warming or what some now call climate chaos, always the new name, is way at the bottom of the list. And I contend that some of it has to do with, you know, having Al Gore and all the factual errors that he had in his documentary, and now he is comparing skeptics to racists in the old South. Do you think he hurts or helps the cause, Dr. Cullen?
Thanks, Paul. Heidi Cullen, go ahead.
So Paul raises a really important point, and that is just public perception of climate change in the United States. And I'll just say that I use climate change and global warming kind of interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, global warming is just the average temperature increase, whereas climate change takes all of the different things into account, the droughts, the flooding events, things like that. So I think it's okay to use them interchangeably. But so, Paul, what we've learned over the past several years when it comes to the United States, that there's roughly six different Americas when it comes to concern about global warming. There's the folks who are alarmed. That's about 13% of the U.S. population. There's the concerned. That's about 28% of the population. There's the cautious, and then we go down. There's the disengaged, the doubtful, and then the dismissive. And the doubtful and the dismissive are both about 12% of the population. And I'll say that, you know, those are the folks that Al Gore could never reach. But the kinds of people that I would say Al Gore does reach are folks who are actually incredibly alarmed about the issue. And these are the folks that we consider, you know, the issue public. These are the folks who are going to their congressman and saying, you know what, you have my permission to care about this issue. Because we have seen climate change fall off the radar. And, you know, it's fallen off the radar for all of the obvious reasons. We're in the midst of two wars. We've got a terrible economy. We've got a high unemployment rate. And ultimately speaking, that has you know, taken over the front of people's minds right now. And it makes complete sense. And I think one of the things we really have to help folks understand is that by tackling climate change, we can actually address some of the larger issues that are plaguing us. And you know, unemployment is one of them. And that this issue is, mm-hmm. is directly tied to our energy economy and our national security.
So what do you call skeptics?
You know, I would say that the way the Six Americas plays out is the folks who are alarmed and concerned, they basically just want to know what they can do to stop it. And then you've got the folks who kind of fall under this cautious and disengaged group, and they want to know, why should I care about it? How is it impacting me at the local level in my community? And then, you know, the folks who are highly skeptical, the folks who we call the doubtful and the dismissive, these are the folks who don't necessarily trust the science. They're the folks who say, why should I trust you and how do you know it's real? And that's why, you know, at the beginning I was saying there's four basic things that we really need to help people work through. And that is, it's real. We know that it's human caused. We know that it's a threat and that ultimately we can fix this. And that's the only way that we can, you know, really bring the U.S. as a whole together. And like I said, ultimately, allow us to give our representatives permission to care about this issue, because, you know, for the past few years, it's been one of these issues that a lot of, you know, congressmen and senators have been kind of afraid to care about.
Well, Paul, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what James from Valley Forge has to say. And James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. There have been other victories that environmentalists are trying to get the word out about. 1987 was the Montreal Protocol, where we fixed a hole in the ozone by choosing to put different things into aerosol cans. Also, there used to be the phenomenon known as yellow fog, which was a phenomenon of the Industrial Revolution, where we burned so much coal in cities on a still day, we would create a dome of smoke that would turn yellow and would kill people. And humanity has made other choices, and we don't do that anymore.
Well, James, let me take your point, and those are interesting issues that you raise. And Heidi Cullen, can we take a lesson from what we figured out about how to reduce the hole in the ozone? Does that apply to global warming or climate change?
Well, you know, I think James makes a really good point, and that is, we have had issues in the past, like the ozone hole, where globally we've come together. I mean, the Montreal Protocol is sort of held up there as one of these shining beacons of success. And I think the trouble with climate change is that it's unlike any other pollution problem because the solution deals with energy. And it's this combination of a development issue as well as this environmental problem. And so this dream that was Kyoto, the fact that we could have this one treaty that would be like the Montreal Protocol and set, you know, these emissions mandates, I think folks are kind of coming to the realization that it's not going to be that simple. Hmm. We can't separate development and pollution, and we've probably are going to have to come up with more of a patchwork approach that holds different countries accountable in different ways, where the U.S. will have domestic goals. We will be working with our international partners. But I think that climate change is kind of a tougher problem than we've seen. And so having a one treaty solution is probably not going to work.
James, thanks for the call. Let's see what George from, looks like Allentown has to say. And George, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks.
You're welcome.
The reason I wanted to call is there was just some research done that was done using actual measurements that said that our estimates on greenhouse gas retaining heat were dramatically overstated. And I see this met with pure silence, dismissiveness. Why aren't we adjusting the models when we get real information?
And George, this is a study from Washington University, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
One other quick
comment.
Sure.
The idea that fluorocarbons helped. That's something that's heavier than air. When that comes out of a can, they go straight down. How did that help the ozone?
Well, I hear you, but let's take the first point because that's really germane to what we were talking about. And this is some research that I frankly am not familiar with, Heidi Cullen, but coming out of Washington University, raising questions about some of the modeling.
Right. So, yeah, George, thanks for that question. I believe that that's a paper that was published recently in Remote Sensing. And my sense of that paper was that it was using a fairly short record, and it wasn't necessarily, I feel like the headlines, it actually did get a fair amount of pickup, and I feel like the headlines that were constructed around that research study were a little bit overstating what the study itself found, which was, you know, simply that in this short record that there was some uncertainty around, you know, what was essentially, you know, radiative forcing escaping. And ultimately, I don't think that study changed the overall finding that it's warming. So, you know, again, I think that there's aspects of the problem where there's further study needed. But I do think that the kind of fundamental increase in overall temperature is one of these aspects that has remained fairly solid over a very long period of time. And so I guess the short answer is that I know the study you're talking about, and I think that it really doesn't change our overall understanding of the issue in any large way. It just sort of pointed to some uncertainties in a fairly short data set.
George, thanks for calling into Radio Times. His question, though, does raise this question of certainty. And I know for scientists, that's something that you grapple with. But I think sometimes the public understanding of certainty might be different from a scientist's understanding.
Yeah. And it's funny because, when I was at the Weather Channel, we wanted to do a series of stories on uncertainty. And I can just tell you that when I was pitching that series, it didn't necessarily go over well.
And, no, didn't it?
Again, it's not the sexiest topic out there, but it's one of those things that I find highly fascinating. And it's funny because when scientists use the word uncertainty is something that you study and you try to estimate. You try to put bounds on the level of uncertainty that you have. And so for the general public, when we hear the word uncertainty, it's like, they don't know.
Exactly.
When in essence, uncertainty is for us something that allows us to bound a problem. And, you know, I'll point back to this U.S. National Academy's report that said, with climate change, we don't know everything, but we know enough to get started. And it's one of these problems where you move forward and then you do a mid-course correction and you keep moving forward, because in the end, it's so much cheaper to work on the problem now. And, you know, I'll wrap this up by just saying that the thing about climate change that's hard is that by the time you really, really see it and the attribution is, you know, massive, it's too late to fix. And that's where our understanding as a society of science and our understanding of a long-term forecast is kind of our ultimate challenge. Because if we don't believe that by the middle of the century there'll be massive prolonged droughts in the U.S. Southwest and that the European heat wave will be happening every other year, if we can't internalize those forecasts, then it's really hard to fix, because it's such a big procrastination problem where the longer you wait to fix it, the harder it gets.
That being said, do you, and I realize part of your mission is to try to convince people that it's real, but are you optimistic that the public and even elected officials will take this issue seriously as you do?
Gosh, I'm hopeful. You know, I think that look, scientists have told us things that we haven't necessarily wanted to hear for a very long time now, starting with Galileo.
and
you know,
and we
so
know what happened to him, right?
Yeah, right. And so for us to think that this is, you know, that this is an easy pill to swallow, you know, we just have to kind of keep doing our best to help people understand the significance of this finding. And like I said, you know, when you basically over a period of a century come to understand that burning fossil fuels is probably not the best choice in terms of building an energy infrastructure, it's going to have significant political ramifications. And, you know, it's one of these things where science will always be political. It should never be partisan, though.
Well, on that note, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Heidi Cullen, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And she's a senior research scientist with Climate Central, which is located in Princeton University, where she's also a visiting lecturer at Princeton University. I should say Climate Central at Princeton. And she's a visiting lecturer at Princeton University. And her book, out in paperback now, The Weather of the Future. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show.